It was an immense privilege for the latest in my series of nostalgia interviews to catch up with Wendy Dossett. Wendy and I have known each other for over 30 years. Wendy is based in Chester, where she is an associate professor of religious studies, specialising in Buddhism. Wendy has also been an A-level examiner. We talk about addiction, recovery, spirituality, growing up in Hastings, what it is like to return to the place of one's birth, the teachers who actively chose to teach in a school with challenges. We talk about live music and the first gigs that Wendy went to when she was young, the importance of pop nostalgia and of lyrics, the moment in timeness of seeing an artist live. We find out about her mother's Anglicanism and her father's interest in the paranormal. We talk about the interplay between Buddhism and nostalgia and the changing nature of the self, reflecting on our past in the light of addiction recovery and whether change is possible. We find out about the project that Wendy is undertaking around such fellowships and the concept of higher power. We talk about the importance of ordinary experience versus the power dynamics that lead some figures to be presented as authorities. And we talk about who are the legitimated voices in any discourse. We talk about the importance of the alchemy involved when people share their negative experiences of the past and of busting shame, and how we are all struggling human beings. We find out what Wendy's younger self wanted to become when she was older, and whether she looks back more than she does forward. It was a huge privilege for the latest in my series of nostalgia interviews to catch up with Wendy Dossett. My name is Chris Deasy. Well, my guest this afternoon is Wendy Dossett. Now, Wendy, we've known each other for, it must be 30 years.
I think it probably is about that. Yeah. What year did you come to Lampeter?
Well, I went in 91.
Okay.
And I think, and we were in touch about this a while ago, I think there was something that you ran called, was it Beechwood Society?
It was.
That was in 1992. So that is my first, to my knowledge, the first time I ever met you.
Yeah.
That was a weird evening.
It was a weird evening.
Was it like people talking about seances?
It was, yeah. We had Professor Parrott from Aberystwyth University, musicologist, who channeled, or well, he wrote about somebody who channeled musicians of the past. So yeah, he gave a speech.
Because I was an undergraduate at the time, and I thought, oh, this might be useful, because I was doing something on modern theology and life after death with Paul Badham, who's known to both of us. And I thought, well, I better take some notes. And actually, I've got in this very office where I am, I've got my notes from that occasion. And there was a point where I thought, I'm not sure I want to put this in my essays. It's like, this is really going off. But for a Friday night, very memorable, but very, very sort of off kilter.
Yes.
And do you want to say, Wendy, what you're doing now?
Yeah, sure. I'm at the University of Chester. I'm an associate professor of religious studies. My religion specialism is Buddhism. So my PhD was in Buddhism, but not Buddhist studies as such. It was a religious studies thesis that looked at the history of Buddhist studies and how Japanese, a particular form of Japanese Buddhism, was understood in the West. Yeah. And I've been involved in the religious education world for many years as an A-level examiner and a person interested in the curriculum subject in the UK. And in recent years, I've studied addiction, recovery, spirituality. That's what I work on most of the time these days.
Yeah. And the number of people in so many different walks of life, including people who I knew maybe at university or afterwards who were involved in the school teaching profession, of course, know you. And we knew each other in Lampeter, as I think is pretty obvious from the discussion. And it's so interesting because we both had the same supervisor, of course. And we're still in touch with that same supervisor who has a book out at the moment, of course, which is very good. And we were talking over lunch before we started recording about the way that, of course, our time in Lampeter has impacted on us. But how weird it is for us now to be in Canterbury and we have that big Lampeter connection. Which stretches back over so many years.
Yeah, well, I was in Lampeter for 23 years, so it was an enormous part of my life, and it shaped me as a person in in all sorts of ways, not just academically.
Yeah, and of course we both saw each other at the big reunion, the 200th reunion in the summer. So that was, that was a big event. And also, of course, there's a Hastings connection.
Yes.
Were you born in Hastings?
I was born in Hastings, yes, in 1969.
Oh, well, see, I was too polite to ask. But that was, that might have been my next question. No, it wouldn't have been. But yeah, and so growing up in Hastings, in a seaside town.
Yeah.
And quite a few, as I remember, because I knew quite a few people who were from that part of the world. I was married to one of them actually once. Who were from Hastings, who went to Lampeter. So, and I was in. I thought, is that just a coincidence? Is there a ley line that runs between them? But I'm always interested. A coastal town. What was it like growing up in Hastings?
Well, it's hard to say because you've got nothing to compare it with. So yeah. I didn't grow up anywhere else. Yeah. So I loved growing up by the sea. Hastings was a relatively deprived town compared to some of the other settlements along that south coast, but I don't think I was aware of that. I went to a school that I think at the time was considered quite a rough school. That didn't bother me. I enjoyed it for the most part. You know, I appreciated the kind of culture that I was growing up in. And I've got very fond memories of Hastings.
Yeah, and it's interesting, isn't it? As we get older in life, sometimes there are all these different places where we set up camp for different periods, and often are still in touch with the people from that era.
Yeah.
And sometimes those people stay put, and or we move, or we all move, and maybe in a completely random place we all sort of like catch up, or maybe we meet online. And is that your experience as well? So are there lots of people from that sort of that time in your life, family, friends, who that you're still in touch with, and you sort of check in and follow how your paths maybe diverge?
I think Facebook has been very useful for that, and I've caught up with more people in recent years through that. But yeah, I've got close school friends who I've been in touch with for the last 45 years or so. So yeah, I am still in touch with that part of the world. I have a kind of, I do go back to Hastings every now and again. I don't want to go back to the house that I grew up in. I want to keep that in my memories. I don't want to see what it's like now. And I'm very different to other family members in that regard. My sister's quite happy to go back and have a look, and she's curious. But for me, I don't want to see what it's like now. I want to keep it in the memory.
Yeah, I was the same with Cardiff, actually. It took me a long time before I could really go back to some of those places from my ancient past. But even Lampeter as well. It was, I think, about 16 years after I left before I felt ready to return again. I think enough time had passed, and maybe keeping a diary as well. So I sort of had enough, there's enough of a sort of a record of that past for me not to worry too much if it changed drastically. Maybe I was just curious to see what was going on. But so are you in touch with many of those school friends?
A few, yeah, a few. Yeah.
And do you kind of feel, you mentioned you went to a rough school.
Yeah.
Do you feel that the education that you had there kind of steered you in the direction of what you're doing now? Because at the time, I mean, obviously, at a young age, you're not going to be thinking about what will I be doing in my 40s, 50s or whatever. Mm. But in terms of sort of the professional work you've done, and you work in education, I'm guessing that there's a clear sort of sense that when you're dealing with school children or university students, you know what it was like maybe to be in an environment where learning, you know, had lots of challenges.
Yeah. Well, RE wasn't offered in my school. So I can't say that shaped me. The teachers that I most admired tended to be the teachers who had a kind of political sensibility about them, who had actively chosen to work in a school like that because they were broadly left wing. And I became aware of that, I think, especially as I got into the sixth form, and I respected that. And, you know, I had, for instance, a wonderful English teacher, Mr. Stewart, who my degree was half a joint honours degree in English and religious studies, and he was instrumental in inspiring me in English, but also just in terms of worldview and outlook, and just a kind of a left wing sensibility that I picked up at school.
Because you sometimes find that there are some people and, you know, teachers who might be brilliant. You know, they'll teach the curriculum and very inspiring. But it's that hinterland. And I remember, yes, the things I remember most from school are not necessarily the stuff that we were supposed to be doing in class,
yeah,
but it was all the extra stuff. Like, we had an English teacher who, always looking back, you'd think, gosh, you know, in some ways he may not have been a good teacher, because he would go wildly off the syllabus, maybe because he didn't, you know, maybe he hadn't prepared for it, or what, you know, whatever the reasons were. But we'd have all these debates, and we used to love those classes because it felt like we could sort of own the conversations. We could do things very idiosyncratically, very creatively.
Yeah.
Whereas when we then had another teacher, maybe even in the same subject, and we'd be going through a particular book, and we'd be doing it sort of almost like line by line, and we'd feel, God, this is boring,
yeah,
you know. And yet that was, you know, ostensibly what the subject, you know, should have been about. So it's, yeah, it's the teachers,
yeah,
and also, and I found this with university teachers, the style of teaching, the style of delivery. I mentioned Paul Badham earlier, but
yeah,
people who have a very creative, idiosyncratic way of delivering material can be hugely influential. I'm very aware that when I'm teaching in a university context, I'm kind of channeling that sort of mode of delivery. You know, it inspired me, and I'm sort of using that to hopefully inspire my own students. If you have those sort of experiences as well.
Yeah, I think I'm sensitive to when somebody who's teaching me is motivated,
yeah,
and trying to achieve something in the room, and I respect that. You know, I might not agree with it always, but, you know, I hope that I'm that kind of teacher, that I, you know, it's not just the content, it's what, you know, what's happening in that educational exchange and what might be happening for those students in the room in terms of their own lives, their professional development, their futures. And looking back at my teachers, you know, being absolutely sure that they were influential on me in that way, and kind of hoping that I'm the same, I guess.
Yeah. And are there particular, you know, earliest memories from growing up? Maybe gigs that you went to or discos? I think we've had exchanges about discos on the pier.
Oh,
is that,
yes,
right? Is that right?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Gosh,
so,
which, yeah.
So I knew Hastings, obviously, in later years.
Yeah.
Whenever I go back, I always think, oh, this was Wendy's stomping ground, because obviously.
The pier
you must have
disco.
Some,
yeah. Oh, my
what
goodness.
Was that like, Friday night type of thing?
Oh, totally, yeah. It was the thing in Hastings, the pier disco.
Yeah.
Yeah, getting bevied up before you went, and having a great time,
yeah,
absolutely.
And,
yeah,
and music as well, and this is something that we've obviously been talking about, it has been hugely influential, because you still go to gigs. We were talking before,
yeah,
we started recording this about, you know, James Taylor. You saw James Taylor
I
in
did.
Concert. Was it in Birmingham?
In Birmingham last week,
Last
yes.
week, which
yeah.
is amazing. And I'm a huge Carly Simon fan, so that's,
yeah,
that's maybe we'll come on to that. But also, you were telling me Bob Dylan, there's lots of artists, and you've
yeah.
gone quite a way actually to try and catch some of them in concert.
Yeah. I mean, I love live music, and you know, I grew up listening to the charts, as I know you did, and music was really important to me as a teenager, and my musical taste has changed over the years. I think, you know, I had the classic teenage taste, you know, when I was 13. First gig that I went to, actually, my dad took me. I went to see Adam and the Ants. It was absolutely fantastic. I have no regrets about that whatsoever. Then I had a bit of a dark period. but that I emerged from that, and I got into American protest music, basically. Mm. And I was about age 16, 17, I got into Bob Dylan.
Mm.
And he's kind of been with me all my life, really.
Yeah, and there's a two-tone link as well, is that right?
I loved two-tone music as a teenager, yeah. I mean, Madness and Scar, Rocksteady and two-tone.
It's funny because obviously there's not a huge age difference between us, but for me, 1981, I was, what, eight, seven going on eight, and that's suddenly when Adam and the Ants, you know, and even to this day, remembering that video of Stand and Deliver when he puts, well, it looked like he was putting, like, Tippex or, you know, paint on his face.
Well, that's what we did.
Yeah.
We did put Tippex on our faces.
And the special, there's a funny story about that. I remember probably was around that era. Maybe the teacher either didn't let on that she knew who Adam and the ants were, or just didn't know. And I remember this exercise when we had to read words to see, you know, at the age of six, start with the very easy words, like the three-letter words, then the four-letter words, five-letter words, and see how far we could go. And she said, don't worry, you're not going to reach the end of the page, but, you know, see how far you can go so we can just determine your level. So I did this, and she said, oh, you've done quite well. And she said, are there any other words on the list? And I was looking down, and I thought, these words, I've never heard of these words. And suddenly I saw one that stood out, and I said, I know that one. It's adamant. And she said, oh, that's a really good one. She said, it's actually adamant, but that's really good. And I thought, and it suddenly that just gave away in one moment. Of all the words on the page, yeah. I would find one that are completely fitted in with, you know, the influences from outside of school.
Yeah.
And the other funny thing was actually about the specials on Ghost Town. Mm. Remember this disco? So it would have been around July 81. And of course, I just thought, and the video is, you know, has lots of meanings in it, but because I just thought, oh, they're at a fairground and it's sort of a ghost town going on a ghost ride, like in Hastings at the at the part there. And of course, there's a lot more. And of course, this was the age of the Brixton riots.
Yeah.
You know, 1981, there was a lot going on politically and socially and economically. So that completely fits then. That so that sort of marks you out. That was your era. That was you grew up with a lot of those artists.
Well, that song Ghost Town really makes me think of Hastings, with all due respect to Hastings. I don't think it was about Hastings. Was it about Coventry, I think?
Yeah, but that's where Terry yeah this from, yeah.
But that kind of desolate sort of town riven by unemployment and so on. You know, it could have been about Hastings. That's what I... Those are the memories that come back to me when I listen to it today.
Yeah, and it obviously struck in because that was a number one. But at my age, that was very different from a lot of the other number ones from that year.
Mm.
And it's only looking back that I realised, you know, quite how bleak a song it is. There's a sort of a moment... There's like a carnival-esque bit in it with sort of, you know... But it's a... And then it goes back into into the ska groove. And it's, you know, sort of... It's very powerful and evocative.
Mm.
But do you listen to all that music even now, and does that sort of bring up a lot of these memories from that era?
Yeah, it does. I mean, yeah, I've got my playlists, and you know, I love all the kind of pop nostalgia programs on TV, as I'm sure you do as well.
Yeah,
I like going back over that stuff because it shaped me, and I, you know, it shaped my views about the world, really.
And I find that interesting, isn't it? Because when I was in the playground at school, music was always something that would be brilliant in terms of, you know, we'd all have our favourite songs and we'd be like, you know, my song went up five places, but yours went down three. You know, so there was always that sort of element, that was sort of competitiveness.
Yeah.
But also what it did, it showed our allegiances, our alliances, where we fitted in,
yes.
who were our go-to type of people.
Yeah.
And I think that could be hugely beneficial. And also sort of marks out sort of friendships and common conversations. But then you sort of see the wider sort of the subtext of the music, and you see then you look into the reasons why the art, you know, when you're older, you look into maybe the reasons why the artists wrote that, and you realise that it's, you know, sure they make it for money, etc. But there's also a clear message that they need to impart. And it sounds like you've absolutely tapped into that.
Yeah, I think I'm always interested in lyrics. Obviously, the sound hooks you in. And with two-tone, that really is a distinctive sound, isn't it? And it does hook you in. But it's the lyrics and the stories and the messages that really drive it for me.
Yeah. And what's the most number of times you've been to see a particular artist on stage?
Oh, definitely Bob Dylan.
Yeah.
I'd have to kind of sit down and work it out, but I would say probably... somewhere in the teens now. Yeah.
That's really impressive. And of course, he's still... Did you say you're going to see him?
I'm going to see him in a couple of weeks' time. Yeah.
And you did... And I have to... Now, it's the elephant in the room, is that you're going to be too shy to mention this. But for some reason... Now, this is really interesting. You were like... Kajagoogoo. But I was like, what's wrong with that? Although it's a bit, it's not quite Scar, I guess. It's a difference in a genre. No. But you went to see them, did you say five times?
Six times.
What a difference. Yeah.
Can you feel the shame dropping off me?
Well, your colleague, you have a colleague. I've interviewed her and she's talking about this, but the whole Bucks Fizz thing. Yeah. So we all have these.
We've all got this. Yeah. Yeah, my colleague brazens that out, whereas I just cringe. I mean, I was 12, 13 probably, and I, like many other young people, mainly girls, of my age. They were the band, I'm afraid. But I grew out of them, I'm happy to say.
So it wasn't a never-ending story.
I knew you were going to do something like that, Chris.
Oh, yeah.
You're so reliable.
I know. Well, I did a lot of research for this, as you can tell. But that's interesting because, you know, growing up as well, because for me, film came much later.
Yeah.
But and you mentioned live music, but this is the funny thing, because I have this huge radio obsession. Mm. I also have a big film obsession. But you'd think that the obvious sort of follow-up for me from the radio, the music interests, would be to go to see bands live.
Mm.
And I kind of, I'll happily do it, but I saw with a friend, actually, Rich King, Hall & Oates a few years ago. That was great. But we were sat quite near the back. And there were lots of people around, lots of people with their, you know, drinking and walking back and forth. So I didn't feel really part of it.
Yeah.
And I tried to work out why, because I thought, you know, I grew up with I Can't Go For That, No Can Do, and all the rest of it. But for some reason, it didn't have the same effect on me as, like, going to the cinema. And yet, you'd think that would be a natural extension of my radio interests. So I'm interested in the sort of the live music thing. And for you, is the live music more important than listening to the vinyl or the CD?
No, I love listening listening to it. Mm. Because you can really concentrate then and hear the lyrics. But I mean, Bob Dylan is an interesting one because he's not a great live performer, and he's well known to annoy audiences by, you know, kind of singing offbeat and, you know, his voice, lots of people don't find it very attractive. But for me, I think it's honestly just being in his presence, which sounds a little bit extreme, but, you know, to see that, you know, he's real and, you know, he is communicating in that moment, and that's a moment that in time that, you know, you'll never get back. You know, I'm very keen to see him this time because, you know, he's I think 82 now, and this might be the last chance.
Yeah.
But I mean, I know the gig won't be the quality. I mean, James Taylor, the quality of the live music was absolutely superb, and it really was. It was in the NEC, and it was a great performance, and I was a long way away, but it didn't matter. It felt very intimate and a lot of work, obviously. And some very professional musicians with him, and it was absolutely brilliant and really moving to me. And I know Bob Dylan won't satisfy me in the same way, and I'd, you know, much rather listen to the CD or whatever. But it's the kind of pilgrimage element of it, really.
Yeah, and actually, is there a rapport with the other people in the audience?
Yeah,
I mean, I don't know if you go on your own or it's just that you're communing with all the other people in this large stadium, effectively.
Yeah. I mean, I went to see James Taylor on my own. I'll be going to see Bob Dylan on my own. It's that sense that this is a moment in time, and that artist is there. And that will never be repeated.
Yeah, and it's interesting because sometimes I have this need sometimes to almost go back to source, almost like if I've got copies of things recorded off the radio years and years ago, so it's almost like this is my memory of something that happened, and here's the evidence, here's the actual like hard copy version. But at the same time, like with film sometimes, I'm very happy to watch old films, should we say, in a new medium, by which I mean a new a version that's high definition, you know, watching something which looks a lot better, you know, completely spruced up compared to the version that I might have seen all those years ago. So there's that sense of improving on the original. But of course, when you see a live performance, then inevitably you're going to sometimes think, oh, you know, that chord was done differently, or that's not quite the version totally. That I remember.
Yeah.
Or maybe the audience are allowed to interact and they sort of, you know, take over. But that must be really exciting. But I'm trying to work out in my mind why I'm not as keen to see live music as I feel I ought to be. And yet these artists are the ones. Maybe perhaps that's the other angle. Maybe if I had a chance to sit down with Bob Dylan or James Taylor, that would be phenomenal. Being one person among hundreds of thousands potentially in a big audience, maybe that it's you're that close, but also so far away at the same time.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, I mean, I used to have a habit of sitting outside Dylan concerts at the end and just listening to people talking as they came out and how disappointed they were in the performance.
Yeah.
But I mean, he's famous for that. So you don't go and see him live for the quality of the performance. Yeah. You go for something else.
Yeah.
That's my feeling about
it. There's probably something liminal about the whole thing. I mean, that I'm you know, communitas and all that, but that sense of suddenly everyone is there.
Yeah.
You've all come from different places.
Yeah.
I suppose with the Queen's funeral recently, one of the projects I'm doing at the moment is going over all the whole, you know, the different way the death of the Queen was carried on radio, and people were writing in about their memories and their experiences of queuing up and all the rest of it to see the coffin. But I find that so interesting, isn't it, that you go to see this event, but also the thing you'll remember is the way the audience is carried away, or not, as the case may be, of course, by what's happening on the stage.
Yeah.
So your memory is as much of, you know, being in the audience. It's about where you are situated and who you're situated with, as much as the person, the icon on the stage.
Yeah, I remember sitting outside one a concert afterwards and hearing people moaning about it as they came out. But then as the crowds, we moved into an underpass on the way to a car park, and everybody burst into like a Rolling Stone in the underpass. So, you know, you talk about communitas, that's that sense of kind of togetherness that people had even after an unsatisfactory, in their view, experience of live music.
How do you feel when other people cover the music? Because Simply Red did this version once of the
Positively
4th Street, and there's a version they did which I quite like, but it's a very sort of poppy version. But I remember thinking at the time that a lot of the real fans would probably really turn their noses up at that.
I wouldn't like that. I mean, I can tolerate Jimi Hendrix All Along the Watchtower, but that's about it. Really, the Birds, you know, I like the Birds, so I can cope with their cover versions. Peter, Paul and Mary, Blowing in the Wind. But yeah, generally the original's better.
Yeah, absolutely. And I mentioned films. I mean, was that something that was quite big for you growing up? Or
yes, definitely. I mean, seeing Star Wars, E.T. was a big one. Yeah, Greece.
And did you watch these in Hastings?
Yeah, in the Odeon in Hastings.
Yeah. I've been there.
I loved going to the cinema. That was a really a nice thing to do.
Yeah, I went through a period recently, and it was completely coincidental. But in the same week, there were two films showing at the cinema, different cinemas in this area, which I'd seen when I was very young. One was E.T., which I saw when I was 9 or whatever. And the other one was, and I was probably even younger than that, and it was one of the Star Trek films. Maybe it was the first one from 79. And it went over my head completely, but they were showing it at one of the cinemas here a few weeks ago. So in the course of 1 week, I was going to see films in my very late 40s that I saw when I was, you know, in single digits. And that was interesting. So that sort of reconnection and trying to work out what I would have got out of that as a 9-year-old, compared to, you know, what I might think of that now. And that's so it's the journey. You mentioned pilgrimage in relation to going to concerts, but also I think that's an element that plays a big role sometimes in even films as well. It's not just watching a film in isolation, and it's nothing to do with the quality of the film. It's the fact that you have a lived experience that might go back decades, and it's the people you saw it with, and the sense of reflection on that, which is a big part of the experience.
I
have to ask you about how you got into your career in religious education, and, you know, I know you did English and religious studies at Lampeter at university, but what made you choose those subjects, and what sort, you know, because obviously that's what you're doing now, obviously. So was that accidental? Was it, you know, what made you do those subjects at the time that you did them? And you probably couldn't have imagined at the time that you might have ended up following this as a career.
Yeah. Well, English, because of my A-level, which I loved, and Mr. Stewart, my teacher, who inspired me. And I did okay in English, so that seemed like a good thing to do. But I had these kind of burning religious questions that teenagers often do, I think. I brought up Anglican. Well, my mum was an Anglican and we went to church. My dad was interested in the paranormal, in ley lines. He was a dowser. He doused ley lines. Interested in psychical research and so on. So I came from a background of people kind of questioning beliefs, and you know, that fascinated me. I was due to get confirmed at church, and I decided that I didn't want to do that, and I didn't really know why. And you know, and I told my mum that I didn't want to, and she was okay with that. But I just, you know, I wanted to know the meaning of life, basically, and therefore developed an interest in religion. Like, vaguely aware that there are, you know, various religious perspectives in the world, and I was just really curious about them and why believe one thing and not the other, and you know, why is it Christianity is the thing that it seems I'm meant to be believing in? You know, it's just because I was born into this family. Yeah. So,
but actually, there's an interesting angle. But so you had one parent who was a more sort of traditional C of E sort of background, and then the other who was dabbling in all the sort of, we mentioned the Beechwood Society earlier. Well, I can see where what the origins were of that.
Yeah.
So both together, you were sort of literally following the pursuits of both your parents in that sense, of doing an established degree and looking, obviously part of that would be looking at a traditional religion, but also Lampeter was brilliant at offering all of that, as I did, you know, the all sort of near-death experiences, the paranormal, within that framework. So it sounds like a completely intoxicating kind of environment.
Yeah, I mean, I guess in truth I was rebelling against both my parents. So, I remember lots of heated debates with my dad about ley lines. You know, he would plot them on maps, drawing, you know, the various, you know, tumuli and Scots pines indicate ley lines according to the tradition that he followed. And, you know, he would douse them. And I would have these kind of, you know, teenage angst-ridden questions about this. You know, you could find a line on a map. You know, if you're looking far enough, if your scope is wide enough, you could draw a line. So, you know, I didn't understand the kind of the methodology of it, and I was always very, very critical and had, you know, kind of arguments with him about it. You know, right up until the time he died, really. So I was rebelling against him in a way, and I was also rebelling against my mum's worldview, which is a much gentler worldview in a lot of ways. But yeah, I didn't feel comfortable with either of them. So I had that kind of searching, questing sort of drive when I rocked up in Lampeter, and I really just wanted to learn about, you know, what people all over the world at all points in history had ever thought the meaning of life was, in the belief that I would find the thing that would satisfy me.
And what did your parents think about the degree that you did? I mean, did you have those conversations afterwards in terms of what you'd learned? And, you know, was it something that almost like, it's always interesting, isn't it? It's like the Wizard of Oz, the sort of, you go somewhere, you learn something new, but you return and you have a new perspective on the everyday, on the usual.
Yeah.
So were your parents intrigued by the degree that you were following in the interest, or did you sort of follow up these conversations with them?
I think they were not especially kind of encouraging to me to go to university at all. It's just the culture that we came from. So that was slightly baffling, I think, to them. I think they were probably happy about the subjects I chose, and I mean, I did. Yeah, we'd have conversations about things I learned. I mean, my mum, bless her, she decided that she wanted to read my PhD when I'd written it, and she read it one page a day over the course of more than a year. And she wrote down every new word that she learned from doing that, and you know, she said, oh, you know, it's ever so good.
Yeah. Which was lovely. I actually remember talking to her at your grad. I may even have been, I don't know, sitting next to her, but at the graduation ceremony in 97.
Wow.
And I remember now, yes, I think she said she either was going to or had just finished reading your thesis.
Yeah.
That's lovely. Yeah. That's a lovely way of saying, you know, that was her way of also trying to sort of, you know, support you, but also to show that she was actually genuinely interested in what you're doing.
Yeah,
and of course, and there's the Buddhism interest here. Now, that's very much the angle. And there is something, and you're going to have to tell me all about this, Buddhism and nostalgia, because obviously nostalgia is my thing.
Yeah.
But do you want to say a little bit about that? Because that sounds fascinating in terms of the way that we navigate the past and whether actually is always healthy maybe to go too far down that road.
Buddhism and nostalgia. Well, I guess, you know, if you're looking at classic Buddhist understandings of the self, then, you know, the usual, you know, the common sense view of the self is that, you know, we are the same person throughout the course of our life. We're just kind of moving through time. So, you know, the Wendy that was 7 years old is the Wendy that's here now. It's the same person, but a kind of common Buddhist view would be to say that would be to emphasize the kind of changing nature of the self. So the self is not a kind of fixed eternal essence. The person is a process rather than the idea of an essence moving through time. So, you know, the Wendy that was 7 years old, you could say she's dead and gone and she's never coming back. She's related to the Wendy who's kind of sitting here right now, but she's related in a causal sense, not in a substantial sense, in an essence sense.
Yeah.
So you could say that, that, you know, the person I was in the past is not me.
Yeah.
You know, it's kind of a different emphasis, and it's counterintuitive, I think, to the way that we think about ourselves.
Yeah, because I think there's two things. There's a part of me that almost like needs to cling on to that past, for good or ill. And I suppose things like having a diary and even all the videos and the books that you see around, in a way, that there's a sense of wanting the evidence of that, maybe. But there's also a sense that I have of needing to almost like prove that, yes, you know, same but different, that I've changed and I've, you know, I'm now, you know, somebody who is, you know, I look at some of the things or the characteristics I had all those years ago, and I might sort of now want to be a more confident version of that.
Yeah.
And or whether it's dyeing my hair or whatever it might be, or the clothes that I wear, and I look and think, you know, so it's actually Liz Truss who until, well, I suppose at the time that we're recording this is technically still Prime Minister, but by the time this goes out, who knows what could happen. But something that really annoyed me, because she had this different past and she was a Lib Dem and all that, and she said, oh, show me a 19-year-old who, you know, has various views, and then when that person is 49, and if they still hold the same views, it shows that they're not particularly, you know, challenged, or, you know, they're not thinking for themselves. And I reacted quite badly to that, because I thought there's a part of me that needs that continuity over time.
Yeah.
Now, why that is, I mean, I suppose that's something that I'm probably dissecting, you know, throughout all these interviews about myself, and trying to reflect on that. But that's really interesting about whether it's, you know, maybe it's the letting go-ness, which is very, because I teach bits, obviously, in no way as a specialist, but Buddhism and the afterlife is something. Yeah. But I find that really interesting about that sense almost of what it is about us, if anything that persists, and how actually, ultimately, the idea that we go on forever is absolutely anathema to the Buddhist framework. And that's very different. And, you know, like you, I was on a journey. I went to university to answer all these questions, but I was looking at them perhaps more through a Christian lens.
Yeah. Well, yeah, I mean, I guess the, you know, work that I've done more recently in addiction recovery, you know, kind of people reflect on their past is a very big part of thinking about recovery, and, you know, to what extent was the person who did the things that, you know, they don't want to do anymore, to what extent was that them? I've just spotted a book on your bookshelf, actually, Making Good by Shad Maruna, which is about, I mean, it's a wonderful, wonderful book about how people desist from crime and the stories that they tell themselves about about
what their life was. Yes, I do know. Like. Yeah,
so the kind of idea of re-biographing, you know, it being very important to kind of look back and kind of understand, you know, the kind of motivations for behaviour that happened at a particular time in history that don't have to be repeated in the present. You know, it's not a kind of deterministic thing, and kind of understanding that through narrative, which is what Marina's work is all about, really. How you know, what are the stories that people who manage to, you know, come get out of addiction, have awful experiences of life and have perpetrated terrible things themselves, how do they desist from that? Because, you know, that could feel like a kind of process that is just self-fulfilling and would go on forever and ever. Well, the way people desist is by being conscious of that kind of insubstantial nature of self, that self can be is a process and it can be remade, and, you know, sense can be made of the past, but it doesn't have to continue to be acted upon.
And yes, I do know the book because I met him in Belfast.
Wow. I'd love to meet him.
With all the former IRA prisoners. And they invited me there because they were using the word redemption, but they were not using it in the theological sense. I think they wanted a theologian there to talk about that. And I went, it was one of the most bizarre experiences of my life, because I went and gave this paper. I think I was up first, and I just assumed that everyone in the audience would be, you know, fellow academics. I was, you know, afterwards quite struck that that wasn't the case, and loads of the people there were actually being studied by the criminologists there. They were former IRA prisoners. They'd been released under the Good Friday Agreement. So that's interesting about the sense of whether, you know, well, atonement perhaps is more of a Christian word, but atoning for something that you did in the past in a context, and whether you have to be defined by that, or whether there is a sense of moving on, indeed making good. I hadn't thought of that, looking at that through a Buddhist lens. Is that the context within which you read Shabaruna's work?
It wasn't the context. I mean, I read his work in relation to the work I've done on Alcoholics Anonymous and how people tell their stories in that context. But there are Buddhist approaches to addiction recovery that are very amenable to that kind of idea that, you know, the self is not, you know, it's not a deterministic thing, that change is possible because change is the nature of everything. So that's actually, you know, kind of a message of good news that comes from the Buddhist idea of the self, that the self can be, you know, can be remade because it is being remade all of the time.
And you mentioned all the work on, like, addiction recovery, because there was a book, wasn't there, that had the word salvations in the title, but
alternative salvations,
which was really, and all this turn to the self, which actually I think is very useful for what I'm doing with nostalgia as well, and maybe even with the podcast, the sense of you've got the grand narratives, but you've got people's individual stories, which are often the most compelling ones. But do you, are you okay to mention a bit more about that work on addiction recovery? Because that sounds fascinating, both, you know, in terms of field work, but in just in terms of the way that it is so sort of focused on, you know, everyday experiences rather than dealing with grand ideological or hypothetical or theological constructs. You know, this is something that feels very real to people in terms of, you know, how they manage their own addictions and manage their own lives.
Yeah, sure. Well, I did a big project interviewing over 100 members of 12-step fellowships, and they're like Alcoholics Anonymous, Narcotics Anonymous, Gamblers Anonymous, Sex Addicts Anonymous, various different fellowships. There's lots of them. And I was particularly interested in that study in the concept of higher power and how contemporary members of the fellowships navigate that concept. The Alcoholics Anonymous, which was the first 12-step fellowship to be invented, came out of very conservative, white, male, Christian environment. And, you know, higher power was thought to be the God of the Bible, the God of Christianity. So, you know, how do contemporary members of the fellowship kind of encounter that concept, and what do they do with it? So, you know, I'm kind of interested in the interface between recovery and contemporary culture, basically, yeah. with all the intersections of gender and race and experience and so on. And yeah, kind of just seeing how that concept operated in the lives of people who had changed their lives so significantly that they had gone from, you know, being unable to stop engaging in a behaviour, whether that's drink or drugs or whatever, you know, literally unable to stop, to being able to desist from that, you know, probably against all of their conditioning, all of their genetics. How did they do it? And yeah, it was an absolute privilege to kind of learn about that. But, you know, to think about the term recovery as well. I mean, that's a term that lots of fellowship members use to describe who they are, that they're people in recovery, and they're recovering. Normally they would say, they wouldn't say recovered, but there's a critique of that language as well, because that sounds like it's going back to a time before the addictive behaviour was engaged in. And almost everybody that I interviewed would say, well, yes, it sounds like that, but that's not what I mean by recovery. Recovery is a kind of a moving forward after that event. It's not going back to a kind of pristine state before the issue arose.
Yeah. I find it so interesting that you've got, you know, the way that we are. We can critique ourselves, but in that sort of context. But also, it's very easy for, well, someone like me, I guess, to sort of see various languages being used. I mentioned redemption earlier, and I did a PhD on that, and it's easy then to sort of use that word and say, how can it be appropriated in other contexts? And but in a way, I mean, in film, it's fine because, you know, at the end of the day, I'm not in conversation with the filmmakers; they're not going to care what I write about them. So if I sort of talk about redemption in a particular context, it doesn't really. It's a lens that I use, but in terms of people in a recovery group. It's interesting because is there a sense with the research that's going on, is there a sense that there's somebody here who's almost like trying to find that grand narrative and is perhaps taking what they're saying but using it in a way that they're not necessarily comfortable with? There's like a lot of work on club or even on punk, and you know, you see some of the wonderful work that goes on sometimes where it's like people who say, well, I'm not interested in institutional religion, but the language they use or the pilgrimages they go on or so on seem to very much fit within a religious framework, but you have to find the language that's suitable for them rather than using language that might indicate something that is not really something that they want to identify with. So do you have those sort of experiences?
Yeah, I mean, I guess I'm, you know, I come out of that sort of phenomenological tradition, not in the big P sense, but, you know, as an ethnographer trying to describe what I see and kind of resist those frameworks like redemption. Yeah. Or an atonement and words like that, because obviously those words carry such baggage, and it isn't appropriate to apply them out of context. But what I'm trying to do is listen very carefully to what people say about their own experience, and to reflect the diversity of that, to show how that language that they adopt, and some of them do adopt that language, use that language. But not all of them, and probably not the majority of them.
Yeah.
But to reflect that diversity and to show that it doesn't, you know, they change the way they talk about it over the course of their the recovery life course, as it's sometimes called. You know, people's ideas about what has happened to them change over time as they reflect on the journey that they've been on, and they might use certain language very early on that they wouldn't think of using several years later. That fascinates me. And, you know, it's interesting. You kind of said, you know, take a concept like redemption, take it out of its context and apply it to this group of people. You know, as if it's implied in a metaphorical sense. In fact, you know, the people who do talk about redemption in the fellowships, they mean it in a very real sense, because they've got the lived experience of their life being redeemed. You know, they get it back. So you could say that in the kind of institutional religious or theological context, it's being used in a metaphorical sense, yeah. and you know, in this, in the lives of people, yeah. it's actually being used in a literal sense. Yeah.
And that's why I think the Alternative Salvations book was, for me, really groundbreaking, because it almost gave the green light for me to say, well, yes, because up to that point, I mean, I remember when I started my own research, it was always a case of, you know, let's look at what the big scholars are saying. Let's look at the important people, the Durkheims or whoever mm-hmm. it might be. And you're sort of saying, you know, they're the people who use this language, and the way that they use it is like the stable essence.
Mm-hmm.
But then I was finding, and as you sort of grow over, you know, grow a bit older, you sometimes feel that it's okay to drop your guard a bit. And, you know, whereas when I started, the thought of using like the testimony of, quote, ordinary people wouldn't have fitted within an academic thesis. I've sort of gone the opposite way now, and for me, doing this project, doing all the work on nostalgia is great, because it's not a case of what do all the professional people say. I might interview those professional people, but I'm interested in hearing their life stories, their personal stories, their narratives. You know, I mean, so, you know, in this interview, we haven't been talking, and we could have said, tell me about your second monograph or whatever it might be. That's not the nature of the conversation. But the question would be, why would you write that book, or what are your inspirations? Mm-hmm. And that, for me, is a far more important question, because once you know what somebody's motivations are, then, you know, like with your mum reading your thesis, you know, you sort of, she wouldn't have read that necessarily, you know, if you hadn't been the one who'd written it, but because you wrote it, and because you wrote it, she wanted to sort of try and work out, and no doubt while reading it was probably sort of trying to sort of see how you went from being the child who was in, brought up in this environment where there was some Church of England and also all the paranormal stuff, and then how you got to where you are now, and actually chart that journey. So I find all of this really groundbreaking stuff.
Well, that my kind of interest in ordinary experience really came out of my time with the Alistair Hardy Religious Experience Research Centre, which when I was appointed in Lampeter, so I did my degree in Lampeter, but then eventually got a job in Lampeter, as did you. And I was appointed as an associate director of the RERC, the Religious Experience Research Centre. And that is fundamentally an archive of more than 6,000 accounts of self-defined religious experience sent in by ordinary people, members of the general public, initially to Sir Alistair Hardy, who was a zoologist, who, you know, a Victorian collector of things, really. And, you know, the idea that ordinary people's experience was, you know, a legitimate thing to explore, you know, he was kind of one of the key people to kind of tell that story, basically.
Collecting life stories, I think, that really appeals. So that was going on. So that's interesting, because all that was going on in Lampeter when I was there. But at the time, as I say, I was very aware that it was, and I suppose if you're starting out, and you must find it with your own students as well, that you, in a way, in order to know about sociology or anthropology or zoology or theology, you need to almost, like, you know, you sometimes need to start with the go-to people, and then, you know, once you've got that base, then you can sort of go forward. I suppose you could do it in reverse, but I suppose sometimes for me, I needed that basis, that ballast, and once I had that undergirding, then in a way I felt that I could sort of go off in all sorts of directions, but I needed to start with the, you know, let me go to the authorities. And then after I'd done that, then I could feel a bit more confident. I'd have a mooring, or I'd be steered to be able to sort of know what to do with it. Otherwise, it would just be rootless.
Yeah. I guess I would want to tell my students to question, or invite them to question, why are these people the authorities? Yeah, and, you know, what is the kind of power dynamic in the way that kind of academic discourses have been shaped? Such that the experiences of ordinary people, you know, we look at an experience of an ordinary person and say, well, this doesn't fit, this isn't orthodox or whatever, you know. So, you know, we can, you know, lived religion is you know, a concept that we're, you know, both familiar with. And it, if you look at the study of religion from that angle, from the bottom up, you realise how ludicrous, in a way, a lot of our categories are. People ask me all the time, well, you know, will you tell me whether Alcoholics Anonymous is religious or not? And the problem is that that's a problematic question, because, you know, there's a binary implied there that actually is not borne out in the actual experience of people and the way they talk about their experience. The way they talk about their experience challenges those categories. And those categories are formed, you know, by powerful forces, colonialism being being one of them. And I don't think we, you know, we think about our categories enough, really.
Yes, it would never have occurred to me as a student, and even, if I'm honest, even in this very place now as a lecturer, never occurred to me that, you know, the overwhelming majority of the go-to people were white, male, European and North American, and privileged in that respect. And and in a way, it was almost sort of, I just, because that was my training almost. But in the last few years, a few wake-up calls, because you just realise, because you have far more diverse students, and also these questions come up a lot about, you know, why all the people on the reading list, or there was one of my reading list, and it was sort of over 90% of the people on the list were in the very sort of demographic that I mentioned. And that challenged me, because I didn't feel comfortable with that. And yet it also meant that I was questioning all the things that I had just taken for granted over all the decades that I've been working in this profession.
Well, my PhD was asking questions about, you know, why is it that in Western Buddhism and the Western scholarship of Buddhism, that Japanese Pure Land Buddhism is seen as a kind of marginal form, or, you know, potentially a degenerate form of Buddhism. And, you know, there's a story to tell about, you know, how Buddhism was kind of taken up in the West and what motivated and interested, you know, the Victorians who associated with empire. You know, they loved the idea of a rational religion associated with enlightenment, and, you know, the male questing figure who was going to find out the truth about the nature of reality. It's kind of, you know, Victorian ideal. And that's the kind of Buddhism that people in the West think is proper Buddhism. And then they look at, you know, the vast majority of Asian Buddhism and think, oh, those Asians are doing their Buddhism wrong. And there's a whole kind of power dynamic there that needs to be investigated.
There is a funny story. You just made me think that when I was at Lambeth, because I couldn't deal with how, in the case of Paul Badham, the person who was teaching me and marking my essays was also the author of most of the books that I was writing on. So I almost thought I had to distinguish him from all the other writers. So I was almost like sometimes saying, as the eminent Paul Badham, or as he eminently wrote, it was almost like I need, and that was interesting, because it was almost like because normally, like, there might be a book on the shelf and you kind of feel, well, I don't have a personal connection with this, but, you know, this is the so-called authority or whatever, then fine. But when that so-called authority is the person who is actually kind of very much involved in your own studies, then that's an interesting challenge, you know, to an 18-year-old, about also just, and also being strategic and just making sure that you, you know, you don't find yourself in a position that you say something really staffed, and, you know, and don't do well in the essay. You almost want to please the examiner, please the marker, at least certainly as the 18-year-old, and I suppose my students do the same with me. If they're giving a presentation and they're using something that I've written, they never quite know, because they might refer to everybody else by a surname as DC, but suddenly I'm in the room, so it's as Chris, and they don't know whether to look at me or not look at me. And I sometimes think, I wish I'd written myself out of my own modules, because I feel awkward for them, but it brings back how I felt all those years ago.
But yes, I mean, that tells a story about a power dynamic, doesn't it? And who are the kind of legitimated voices in any discourse, and how did they get there? And you know, what's the power dynamics involved in that?
That's true. So yeah, so in my case, because I put my own books on the reading list, I created a power dynamic.
You did.
And then felt enormously uncomfortable, and I mean seriously uncomfortable, when the students then were worried that if they disagreed with me, that they might get a bad mark. I'd always joke about this and say, you can say what you like, you know, but I was always very clear that, you know, the important thing was that they don't have to just regurgitate what I say,
yeah.
because I will learn from them. And education yes. has to be two-way.
Absolutely.
And I've learned that. But I can also understand why they might be hesitant about that, as
yeah.
I was.
Yeah.
Because even now, to this day, you're still wary of, you yeah. know, various power dynamics and ensuring
yeah.
that they are
yeah.
they are placated.
But having that yeah. conversation with them, you're making that power yeah. dynamic transparent,
yes.
which empowers them to
oh, yeah.
to navigate
yeah.
it.
Yeah.
So I think that's what we should be doing
yeah.
as educators.
Yeah. yeah, I know. I always say the students are always the most important people in the room for that reason, because
mm.
they can make me rethink. If I'm standing for 2 hours and they're not either interested in, or, you know, I might assume that I've put something on the curriculum, therefore I'm going to talk about it for 2 hours. It's important to talk about it, but often you feel the mood of the room, and you have to be sensitive to that, and then work out why did that not work out,
mm-hmm.
and that, so it's a very, you know, no two lectures are ever the same. That's
Indeed.
For sure. That almost sounds as though it could be Buddhist in some way.
Just
a couple more questions as we start to wrap up, Wendy.
Okay.
Would you say that your memories are predominantly positive as you look back on your life and career?
Well, you've reminded me of lots of positive memories,
yeah.
actually, just
yeah.
talking with you, you know, positive memories about growing up in Hastings and positive memories of my parents as well, which is nice. I don't always think in those terms. A lot of my memories are quite negative. I am, temperamentally, I'm quite a negative person, I think. I'm trying to change that. But, you know, I've got an addiction history of my own. And I'm, you know, I'm part of a community that feels that it's important to look back at that, or that we, you know, we often say look back but don't stare. So to remember some of the experiences that I had and the harm that I perpetrated, and the reason to look at it and be aware of it is to become accountable for it and to hopefully not do it again.
Mm-hmm.
So that sounds perhaps quite a negative thing, but when you're doing that in a community, it's not.
Mm.
It's actually, there's something that happens, speaking to somebody the other day, it's like an alchemy, really, where, you know, people are sharing their negative experiences of the past. When people do that openly, there's a kind of an alleviation of shame collectively that happens, which enables people to recover, which is a very wonderful thing.
Absolutely. But I mean, did you feel that, because now you, those communities are clearly there, and it sounds as though you're, you know, you're instrumental in them, and, you know, you're they're not random, they're very much sort of integral to you.
Mm.
But before 15, 20 years or whatever ago, what happened then? Because without those communities, I guess, and you mentioned shame, there's a mm. sense of just, you know, not telling. Because I've always seen you as a very upbeat, very positive person.
Have you?
Always. Absolutely always. but you never, perhaps, you always know what's going
yeah.
on in people's lives. But that is interesting to me, that the way that we, you know, do we bury things inwardly? The way I've got through particular bad periods is to talk about them ad infinitum. And sometimes they even seep into the interviews, but the interviews are not always about me, but I have been interviewed on my own podcast, and I certainly, you know, go off on one more than once. But that is interesting. So how would you have managed in the past in that sense? Is there that sense almost of without those communities of support, then it must be very precarious, and
mm.
actually everything must be out of alignment,
and
you know, addiction is not going to be controlled.
Yeah, I mean, there are many ways to recover from addiction, and recovery communities are only one way. People, you know, there are short interventions,
yeah.
mindfulness programs, all kinds
yeah.
of different
yeah.
ways of recovering, and there's no one way is better than any
yeah.
other. But there is an immense power, I think, in the collective endeavour of sharing, because of that kind of, it busts shame,
yeah.
and shame is the thing, you know, people have such strange ideas about what addiction is, you know,
yeah.
they think people choose to do it, you know, or that they're weak, or that they're immoral or whatever, and I've never met anyone with an addiction, you know, who's in recovery, who felt good about what they were doing. Mm. Everybody wants to stop. Everybody is deeply ashamed. Mm. And the shame reaches, you know, such catastrophic levels that the only way of doing it, you know, only way of coping with it is to carry on doing what you're doing. So it's an incredibly isolating experience. So, you know, communities therefore are very effective in kind of, yeah, just kind of the antidote to that isolation of addiction, overcoming shame, kind of learning from each other, being inspired by each other, and yeah, having a sense of kind of identity as well. So, you know, I haven't had a drink for 17 years, thank goodness. But you know, it's only recently that I've kind of begun to talk about that in public places. Mm. You know, as you know, you've been asking me to to do this podcast. Yes. for some years, and I've always said no, I can't talk about my life. Yeah. But I'm becoming increasingly comfortable with doing that. Mm. But yeah, it's not easy, because there are things in my past that I really wish weren't there.
Yeah, no, that is really inspiring. It really is, because I'm thinking that sort of sense of, you know, like resting control of a narrative. Yeah. And I suppose it's interesting, because I've had, I suppose there are various, I'm sure, very diagnosable traits that I have. But my way of dealing, and I do, you know, there are various issues, relationship histories or something. But the one thing I have, and it's interesting, and maybe it is the confessional. Maybe it's the sort of turn it around. So rather than the shame of, you know, maybe, you know, people have sometimes said to me, oh, what did so-and-so say, you know, when they found out? And they said, oh, no, they knew from the beginning. Or, you know, people say, oh, did they? So, you know, there are times when I've been quite open. And anybody who looks at my Facebook post or something, you see, or Chris going to the cinema and so on. There's a lot that you can probably read into that. Yeah. There's lots of obsessional things. But in a way, I've seized control of the narrative, because on my terms I'm writing about what I do. Mm. And people might interpret that in all sorts of ways, but I'm kind of controlling the narrative. I'd much rather that than somebody saying, yeah, God, you never guess what he gets up to, whereas I'm out there saying, you know, and I'm just throwing it out and almost doing it in a way, and maybe turning it into a research project, I guess. Yeah. Similar to you, really, because obviously you're studying these very issues. So it's the sort of academia or education as catharsis, as therapy, as, you know, self-counselling and communal counselling.
Yes. I mean, I actually won an award for Unsung Impact. It's a kind of organisation that was kind of trying to ask deeper questions about the REF process and how impact is measured and what kinds of impacts are legitimated by the REF, the Research Excellence Framework, and what's missed by that process. And I wrote in and said, well, you know, one impact that will never be measured in the REF is the personal impact on me as a researcher of undertaking the research that I've undertaken. Mm. You know, even if I were to be open about my own history, you know, that is considered entirely irrelevant by the mechanisms of judging research excellence. You know, it has benefited me. It's enormously, immeasurably, to do the research that I've been doing. Yeah. You know, both the work with 12-step fellowships and my more recent work with Buddhist approaches to addiction recovery impacted my own recovery. You know, I see myself as a recovering person, that it's never a done deal. It's a journey that, you know, I hope to be on for the rest of my life, and it needs to deepen and it needs to progress, and I need to not stand still with it. Mm. And academia has actually given me a place to do that.
Yeah. And so interesting about the REF, because in a way I wonder if this project that I'm doing started because I was aware that there were all these, you know, what is impact? How do you measure impact? Mm. But I was also thinking, but I want to know why people do. What are the once I know the motivations for somebody doing what they're doing, then that's the hook. Mm. And then I'm with them. So in a way, rather than somebody talking about their wonderful impact-laden research. I wanted to know about the impact on the person. So I set up the podcast almost as an anti-impact, but I suppose it's impactful in a different way thing. It was almost like, rather than measuring everything in terms of the outputs of their of the books or the journal articles and so on, I'd suddenly produce all these interviews with people not talking about the product itself or the book or whatever it might be itself, but also about their motivations. Yeah. So in a way, that was another way of wresting control of a narrative where I felt maybe that there was something out of alignment.
Yeah. Well, it's so interesting, isn't it, that academia... You know, if you're looking at it from the outside, you would think, you know, there are all of these objective people doing this highly kind of rational research, when in fact we're all struggling human beings, kind of driven by, you know, especially perhaps in our field. But I think, it's true in so many fields. And not just in arts and humanities, but in the sciences as well. People are driven by very personal questions, and it's never an accident what people are studying.
No, that's right. And also, sometimes you imagine, back to what we were saying about archetypes, you imagine that if somebody's an academic researcher, you almost imagine that is almost as though that was their ambition from a young... They were always going to do that project. That was almost like that, you know. But in many cases, it's the journeys there and the things, maybe the gigs they went to or the various... The interests that they have sometimes... And they're not moulded by the books that they read, but maybe it's by the communities around or the radio or the TV or the films and so on. And sometimes I've interviewed people and just suddenly thought, well, I wasn't... I didn't know about that background, or that's not what I expected you to say. And that's a different form of measure, I say, to the ones that the official ref and other processes tend to give us.
Indeed.
Your younger self then, so back when you were in Hastings and going to those Friday night discos, you know, what would you, if you'd reflected then on what you might be doing all those decades later, what did you think that you'd be doing, maybe compared to what you're doing now? do you have an idea, an ambition about what you might be doing and where you'd be doing it?
Back then, I wanted to be a Coast Guard. So I am an introvert and I'm quite contemplative. So the idea of just sitting somewhere peaceful and looking out to sea was what appealed to me. But you had to have some seagoing experience in the Navy to become a Coast Guard. And in those days, that wasn't open to me. So it's a very male profession. Mm-hmm. So... You know, I abandoned that idea. After that, I always thought I would be an RE teacher. And in a lot of ways, I think that's what I am, really. I'm an RE teacher. But, I do some other things as well. Yeah, I don't think I could possibly have imagined the life that I've had. I feel very privileged and lucky to have done the things that I've done.
Yeah. My very last question... Are you a looking back or a looking forward type of person?
I do a lot of looking back, as I said, because I have to as part of my recovery. And I try not to get anxious about the future. but I do. I think I look back more than I look forward. I would like to think that I value the present, and I have a practice that tries to take me into the present, but I'm not there very often because of you know, anxiety and regret and all of those things. But yeah, I'd say more, I tend to look back more than forward.
Yeah. Well, I'm glad that you finally said yes. I hope you feel that you're glad that you said yes finally to doing the interview. Wonderful to catch up with you, Wendy. Oh, thank you so much.
Thank you, Chris. Thank you very, very much.